welcome to another episode of Science Chat, the Science Communication Podcast. I'm Sean Marshall. Today on Science Chat, we're looking at the history of science and technology, in particular at the National Maritime Museum and Royal Observatory. Because, well, I think history of science is an often forgotten subject, with everybody always looking towards the future. So, sit back and enjoy.
Today on Science Chat, I'm talking to Rebecca Higgett. Rebecca is the curator for the History of Science and Technology at the National Maritime Museum and Royal Observatory. Welcome to Science Chat, Rebecca. Tell me more about your role as curator of the History of Science and Technology.
Well, it's a fairly mixed role, really. It's got different aspects. One side is probably quite traditional curatorial side, that is kind of the intellectual care, as it were, of particular collections. And I look after the astronomy collections of the National Maritime Museum, which is objects related to the history of the Royal Observatory in Greenwich, but also things like astrolabes from, you know, the 16th century. So it's a really wide variety of stuff. So one of my tasks is to catalogue, understand, interpret those kind of objects and to deal with inquiries about them, that kind of thing. I also do work towards exhibitions, so helping suggest objects, interpret objects and scenes and that kind of thing for exhibitions. And then also I do related research for sort of academic conferences, journals and that kind of thing. So quite a wide range of things and addressing lots of different audiences. I talk to you know, adult learners, occasionally school children, all sorts of people all over the place, really.
Yeah, I noted with some interest from the 2009 annual review that the NMM was getting having a year-on-year increase in the number of visits, that it also had a lot of children and adults participating in outreach activities. What kind of outreach activities does the museum get involved in?
Well, it deals a lot with schools. Particularly the observatory has a very active program related to the planetarium and also other sort of group sessions that they offer and so on. I mean, that's not stuff that I'm working so much. We have dedicated learning departments who deal with those and obviously, you know the curriculum and can offer things that are useful to teachers in this country related to the curriculum and so on. So there's a very wide range of activities, but I'm not perhaps the best person to tell you exactly what it is and how many people we deal with and so on. But I mean, if you've looked at the reports, you can see that that side of our business is very growing. There's a great big demand for it, certainly.
Yeah, I also noted on the website that your current research interest is in the relationship of the Royal Observatory with the other scientific institutions and with the public in the 19th century. What have you found in this research?
Well, it's kind of ongoing, but I think the 19th century is a really interesting period for looking at the development of science really into something as we would understand it today, something that is supported by public funding. That's something that, even though people are worried about the level of public funding that we have today, it's kind of taken for granted that there will be some, whereas at the beginning of the 19th century that wasn't taken for granted at all. I mean, certain kinds of research and work were done for very pragmatic reasons, and that's one of the reasons that the Royal Observatory existed at all, was for dealing with navigation, for assisting the Navy and also the Merchant Navy in that kind of way. But kind of what we would see as more kind of pure research, kind of asking sort of open-ended questions, was not something that people accepted at all as being funded. That was going to be something that would be funded by private patrons or by amateurs who had sufficient sort of money and interest of their own. So there's a really huge shift over that era. And I think looking at the observatory is very interesting because it is a government-funded organisation, but it changes vastly. And the kind of range of work it does, the number of people it employs, how it relates to institutions like the Royal Society or the Royal Astronomical Society or amateur associations as well, all of that kind of undergoes a complete transformation. And also, indeed, how it kind of deals with the public. It's a very closed institution, really. It's dealing with specific business at the beginning of the century. By the end of the century, it kind of needs to have a bit of PR. It actually, members of staff are deliberately addressing the public in kind of popular journals and that kind of thing. So that's another huge shift. So I find it a really fascinating time for all those reasons.
And do you think that the change that it had from the beginning to the end of the 19th century, do you think that was in response to, you know, maybe trying to engage the public more so that they could get public funding, or why do you think that was?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's kind of in response to huge social changes, I guess. I mean, there's many more people who are literate over the course of that century, so there are more people who can be interested. People are getting more educated, and science is one of those topics that is generating, you know, huge popular interest over that period. So it's kind of, I think, men of science find they can almost harness something before they realise that it's there to kind of be harnessed, if you know what I mean. There is support there, and it's something that they do realise they can use, and then of course it becomes more deliberate and actually sort of going out and educating people. But it's kind of two-way process. It's quite hard. I don't know that I can say kind of which way it goes, but obviously different individuals take a different response. I mean, there are some who are kind of against the whole idea. I mean, there's George Airy, who was one of the Astronomers Royal through the sort of the main central part of the 19th century, from sort of the 1830s right through to the 1880s. And although he believed that government should fund some science, he always felt that it should be really quite utilitarian stuff that could be shown to be definitely beneficial to people, rather than the more kind of open-ended questions. So he was always kind of slightly fighting against the people, perhaps more famously people like Thomas Huxley, who were very much saying that, you know, this stuff should be funded, men of science should have a vocation, they should get into the business, it was a profession that they could be supported in throughout their lives. So those two individuals are both kind of public scientists in, say, the 1870s, 1880s, and they're coming from very different directions. So there's a lot of kind of tensions, a lot of different views going on at that time.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's a very interesting subject, and it's certainly a subject that a lot of people who are interested in science tend not to look at. And certainly, I mean, a lot of people consider the great breakthroughs in science from the start of the 20th century. But I think that without what happened throughout the 19th century, and, you know, we wouldn't have been able to move forward at the start of the 20th century the way that we were.
Yeah, I mean, and I think scientists sometimes kind of have this fallback position of being defensive and feeling that people aren't supporting them. But kind of looking through history and seeing the kind of very, you know, the great positional authority that they managed to achieve by the end of the 19th century, and that the public, by and large, I'm not saying there weren't necessarily people acting against this, but mostly bad reactions were the result of the complete success that science and scientists had by that stage in terms of having kind of cultural authority. And I think people tend to forget, in a sense, that the huge successes that they've had. And it's kind of almost an unquestioned position now, which is why, I don't know, people don't always realise just how accepted science is as an essential part of our society.
Yeah, another thing that I found very interesting on your website was in relation to the ad hoc nature of the actual buildings of the Royal Observatory themselves, how they came and went depending on the changes in the development of astronomy over three centuries.
I think you're right. That, I mean, astronomy was very successful in doing what it needed to do. I mean, in terms of aiding navigation and so on, and then sort of distributing time was something that Greenwich was obviously very much involved in. These became really essential parts about how to sort of structure a modern capitalist society. I mean, it became, you know, showed the sort of essential worth and importance of science. But I think looking at the buildings at Greenwich, you can sort of trace periods of success and also perhaps relative stagnation when things don't change so much, or periods where government feels that it really does want to invest and periods where it doesn't. I mean, you can't say that Greenwich was ever kind of overfunded. It was always kind of, and it was ad hoc because it was always little bit by little bit. You know, they would sort of ask government for a little bit of funding for a particular instrument to be installed, and it needed a different kind of building or a change to the existing building. And they would get that. But it sort of was always very hard to get anything very substantial out of government. So this is a very kind of English model, I think. It's not like somewhere like the Paris Observatory or in Imperial Russia or somewhere, where you get an observatory sort of that's funded by a patron, you know, to, you know, a really substantial degree in order to make a very strong statement about their belief in progress and modernity and so on. It was always much more this kind of penny pinching and being utilitarian kind of, you know, as long as it can be useful, we'll give you a little bit. We're not going to give you too much, and we're not showing off about this. It's humble, but it's very useful and very accurate and all this kind of thing. So that's kind of Greenwich's role, I think. And that's kind of one of the things that the buildings tell us. And Britain was very much in the lead in terms of astronomy, in terms of practical astronomy, in terms of the instrumentation in the 18th century and sort of the early 19th century, and then perhaps loses ground a little bit, particularly as attention moves away from the purely pragmatic side of the purely positional astronomy into areas like photography and spectroscopy and so on. And that's perhaps where initially continental Europe and then kind of much later in the century the US started taking over a bit in terms of getting the biggest telescopes and that kind of thing. Certainly Greenwich has never really been the site of kind of the largest telescope in the world or anything like that. It was always saying, this isn't kind of the kind of thing we fund. It's not necessarily useful. That's kind of open-ended work that's not for us to be pursuing. So it's an interesting set of tensions that you can see there, and it's kind of all played out in the buildings when you start studying them.
So what other projects are you working on at the moment, Rebecca?
Quite a few, actually. There's a couple of exhibitions I'm working on for sort of 2012. We've got a new exhibition, well, a whole new wing, actually, that's going to be open next year, Sammy Offer Wing, which has got a new dedicated exhibition space as well as library and archive space. And I'm working on what will be the first sort of major object-rich exhibition that will be opening there in 2012. And that's about the River Thames as a kind of site of royal power and pageantry and that kind of thing. So that's something quite different, although we're getting a bit of science and technology in there, looking at sort of the changes to the river in the 19th century, sort of, you know, great engineering projects like some of the bridges or the Thames Tunnel and so on, but a very different kind of area from the other work that I've been doing. Another project I'm involved with is an academic project with the University of Cambridge, which is on the history of the Board of Longitude, which is really just starting out, and it's a five-year project with several researchers based at Cambridge, and me and my colleague Richard Dunn, who's curator of navigation at the Maritime Museum, which is hopefully going to get a lot of interesting new work done on something. It's the story of longitude is one that people kind of think they know, and people may be familiar with David Sobel's longitude book, but that only tells a very small part of the story, and also not perhaps as sort of accurately or fairly as we would like it to be told. So there's a great deal more work to be done there, and that would hopefully feed into, as well as sort of academic work, into exhibitions leading up to 2014, which is the 300th anniversary of the first Longitude Act in 1714. Which sets up the whole board and the prize fund for anyone who can solve this problem of longitude at sea. So that's one of the things we've got our focus on in the years ahead.
Sounds like very interesting stuff. One of the other things I wanted to ask you about was, I suppose because you're involved in the history of science, it would of course make you aware of the role that women played in science in the 18th and 19th centuries. And I do know that you co-wrote an essay about women as the audience at the British Association for the Advancement of Science. How well do you think people understand just what the role of women was at that time as scientific participants, or how important it was?
I think people know individual stories quite well. I mean, there are a few women who get sort of brought out, as it were, you know, Marie Curie and Rosalind Franklin and so on, who get sort of highlighted, but I'm not sure how good people's understanding is of the sort of general position of women and what part they played. And actually, in the essay that you mentioned, I was slightly playing devil's advocate there, because I was there's a tendency by scholars who want to show what women have done, you know, kind of bring the forgotten stories out, to kind of scratch around and try and find individual women who, in a sense, made, you know, because of their position, perhaps not that great an impact. You know, they're kind of lesser figures than many men that we've forgotten, if you know what I mean. So in a sense, I was trying to slightly redress the balance by saying that, yes, okay, there were women who made important contributions in science, and I wouldn't want to say anything against that, but that one of the really important roles they played was as an audience. There are also roles that women made. Bernard Lightman has written about some of the women who acted as popularizers of science, writing books or providing illustrations, scientific illustrations and so on, and they played a very important role in making science kind of acceptable to female audiences, to children, to, you know, middle class readers generally. So that's very key. But I was arguing in that particular essay that women also played a very important role, just being there in the audience and kind of, again, showing that science was something that wasn't kind of dangerous or weird or, you know, anything like that, which kind of at the beginning of the 19th century, which is a period of revolution in a way that we've often forgotten, it could have been like that. But through the British Association, through the support of middle-class women and so on, they managed to both show that science was something that was acceptable and sort of an important part of culture generally, but also towards the end of the 19th century, I've argued that as science became more professional, in a sense it became more and more male as well, and the women in the audience at this very public festivals that the British Association had act as a kind of foil to the masculine professionalism of, again, people like Huxley and Tyndall. We can think of these sort of very famous men of science, but also other sort of lesser lights as well. So I wouldn't say I was being anti-feminist, but I was slightly taking a stance against some of the feminist scholars who have tried to kind of, as I say, find any woman who's contributed to scientific knowledge in any way.
Okay. Well, before we finish up, Rebecca, maybe you could tell us something about the blog that you're involved in, the blog dedicated to the history and philosophy of science.
That's Whewell's Ghost, which I've only got, I mean, it's only sort of started off really in the last few months. And I got involved slightly accidentally, just being, you know, asked if I wanted to contribute through people I've only ever met on Twitter. This is the sort of wonderful 21st century world where everything can happen virtually. And suddenly you find yourself actually spending quite a lot of time on something. And it's been fun to start getting involved in doing that. And what's quite nice is it allows me to think about my discipline quite widely without being tied to, you know, the particular kinds of subjects that really relate to the observatory and the Maritime Museum as part of my day job. So I can kind of look back to things that I perhaps started off as a student looking at, or, you know, kind of just point to things that might be of general interest. So I find it quite nice as a sort of contrast to stuff that I kind of have to do for my day job. But then again, it's also a good way of finding different audiences for those stories as well, people who might not, you know, come to the Maritime Museum or might not come across our work in any other way. And also making sort of contacts with other scholars, because it's a blog with several contributors. So, again, we can sort of all be contributing in this way. I mean, I'd be interested to see how it goes and how well it continues. But I certainly, in the last few months, find out a lot more about history of science blogging. I hadn't realised that there was really any out there, and now I realise there's plenty going on and lots of very lively scholarship and debates going on in sort of the blog sphere. So that's great. And actually something that hopefully will be starting off really in the next month or two is another blog I'll be involved with, which relates to the Board of Longitude project that I was talking about, which will be contributed to by all of the researchers and project sort of team from that, and will be hosted on the Maritime Museum's website. So hopefully I'll sort of manage to cross-post things onto Whewell's Ghost and get, you know, audiences going on both. And I think because we've got a really good set of researchers and, you know, a lot of interesting ideas coming into that project, it should be really interesting.
Okay. Well, thanks again, Rebecca, for talking to Science Chat today.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode. You can find out more about the National Maritime Museum on their website, www.nmm.ac.uk, and you can get some information on the research into the Board of Longitude at www.nmm.ac.uk/longitude. Rebecca is on Twitter as @BeckyFH, and that blog that she spoke about is to be found on www.whewellsghost.wordpress.com. That's W-H-E-W-E-L-L-S. LLS Ghost. As usual, you can find more Science Chat stuff on the blog at www.sciencechat.net/wordpress.